there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Coming to you once again from Hot Springs Village, Arkansas, high atop the Highway 7 Ridge Line from TSPN, the Survival Podcast Network headquarters. Today is Friday, so that makes it one of my favorite days to do a show, because this show's all about you. This is all you guys calling in to the Think Line. That's 866-65-THINK. Again, 866-65-THINK. We call it the Think Line for two reasons. One, sometimes you guys ask me questions and I go, I don't know, or boy, that's a tough one. You make me think. And because we encourage you as the audience to think. You know, I get emails almost every day that say, Jack, love your show, love this, love that, but I don't always agree with your thoughts on fill in the blank. It's usually politics. And my response is always, well, thank God. Thank God you don't agree with everything I say. When I get an email from somebody that says, I agree with everything you say, it scares the shit out of me, because no two people should be thinking 100% alike on every issue, especially stuff as complex as we talk about here. So when I set up the 800 number, God, I guess it was 2 years ago now, I did it with the intention of reinforcing the concept of thinking for ourselves. So love to have your call. I'm currently running about 3 to 4 weeks in backlog. I also want you to know I have a huge backlog of calls that go back pretty far. And if you've been waiting for your call and you haven't heard it yet, and it's been more than 3 weeks, you may want to go ahead and call it in again. I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit to keep the call somewhat time-sensitive. I don't like to go further than 3 weeks back, because sometimes there is some time-sensitive stuff, especially with planning and seasonal stuff like that. So if it's been 3 or more weeks and you haven't heard yourself, call back in. If I go back and find your old one and hear your new one, I'll recognize it and wash it out, and no harm, no foul. All right, before we do that, though, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. Sponsor of the day number one today, Harvest Eating, Chef Keith Snow. You know how great he is, because I just had him on the air not too long ago while I was away. And Chef Keith's awesome because he doesn't just teach you to cook really cool stuff. He doesn't teach you just to cook seasonally and locally. He also teaches you how to cook with your preps. And he's living the lifestyle, man. Keith is a homesteader slash prepper. He used to be a high six-figure earning executive chef for one of the most exclusive establishments in Aspen, Colorado, the playground of the rich and famous. And you know what? One day, he looked at his life and said, I am going to kill myself if I have to continue to deal with these people. He moved his family east. He went east, young man, not west, went out to the Carolinas, bought a beautiful little farm, downscaled his life, started raising his children the way that we all wish we could, and trying to run his business from his home by teaching people how to cook seasonally, locally, and with their preps. That's what Harvest Eating is all about. So check out his website today. Next up today, emergency essentials. You know, when it comes to having food, it's important that we practice eat what we store and store what we eat. But when it comes to trying to get your stockpile past that 90-day to 6-month threshold, it's really very difficult to do without bringing in some long-term storage food items like Mountain House, Yoder's, Providing Pantry, things like that. One of the best places I know to get that stuff is from Emergency Essentials. They really specialize in long-term storage food. So you'll want to check them out, and I think you'll find that there's a tremendous amount of information there. They're at beprepared.com. Again, I don't know how they stole that that domain away from the Boy Scouts, but it does fit them very well. And you'll also find a tremendous amount of informational resources at beprepared.com, articles on getting started, planning out your food storage plan, and things like that. So check out Emergency Essentials at beprepared.com today. Remember, the best way to make sure you're dealing with our sponsors directly and make sure you're dealing with the right company, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on their banners in the right-hand margin. Remember, my sponsors are personal endorsements, and they are overseen by a listener ad council that's made up of moderators on the forum, so that it is not just show up and ask to advertise. I turn down advertisers often because they don't meet the criteria that we've set to make them an official personal endorsement. All right, next up today, I want to remind you guys, check out the gear shop. We have a lot of cool stuff there, including the AOCS copper rounds. Those have been selling like hotcakes. I don't know how long this current run is going to last, so I would get yours while you can. Last but not least, do consider joining the Member Support Brigade. You do that, you get exclusive content available only to members. If you're prior service or active duty military, please email me before you join. I'll give you a special code for our service members. And if you are from another country and you served in your nation's military, I will honor that as well. There's a hell of a lot of guys in the Canadian Special Forces out there chewing dirt with our boys in Afghanistan right now. And there's, you know, if you're a country that's aligned with our guys and you've been out there with them, hey, I want to honor that service as well. However, everybody has a discount available right now. The vacation sale is still ongoing. It will end on Sunday. I'm going to go ahead and run it right through the weekend. The discount code is vacation. You can use the form to join by mail, or you can join online. After this weekend, that sale ends. And I'm telling you now, I'm not running another sale until late into the fall. If you want a discount on your first year of the Member Support Brigade, $35 instead of $50, now is the time. Again, the discount code is vacation. And with that, let's go ahead and get into your calls.
Hey, Jack. Just heard you read that CDC zombie article, and you said that if we were to share that with friends, let you know how it's been received. While I didn't really share that exact article, I have since been listening to this show, talking more openly with people about being a prepper, and it's actually been received really well. Just really being able to go out there and talk to people about what I'm doing, whether that's storing food or building a self-sufficient supply of emergency supplies. It's been working really well, and I found that a lot of my friends and family are really latching on and actually taking measures of their own now. So I just wanted to say thanks for, you know, instilling some more confidence in me to actually go out and talk openly about it. And, you know, I'd just like to encourage the rest of your listeners to go out and do the same. I've found that most people already have interests or skills that relate to some aspect of prepping, whether that be gardening or food storage or camping or even just firearms enthusiasts. So thanks again, and keep up the good work.
Well, great call, and thank you for sharing that. He's talking about the CDC article. For those that didn't see it, CDC came out with kind of a viral marketing ploy to get out the information about basic preparedness, and they said how to be prepared for a zombie apocalypse. And I when I read that, a lot of people were really kind of thinking it was pretty cool, and they thought it was cool the CDC did that and all. And it was going like wildfire in the prepper industry. And what I had said was, I don't really think that this is going to reach a lot of people outside of our circle. This is kind of a preach to the choir thing. It might get CDC some recognition, but I wanted to know, had anybody shared that article with people outside of our general community that were not preppers, and did it do any good? And I haven't heard anything different than what I've heard here. Basically, no. But I have heard more and more people being more comfortable sharing the fact that they're a prepper, and sharing the concepts of preparedness, sharing the concepts of lifestyle planning and being out of debt, sharing the concepts of growing some of your own food. And here's really, when people say, well, what is the Survival Podcast really all about? What is your show about? Here's what I tell them. My show is really about self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and liberty. That's really what it's all about, because it's not liberty in a political way. It's about liberty for yourself. And what I'm finding is that when I tell people that, they are very receptive and they do want to know more. But I'll also tell you that I have noticed a shift in the last year. It seems like the general public is becoming much more receptive to these concepts. I think it's a combination of a couple things. One, there's actually been some positive coverage of what we're doing by mainstream media. Not a lot of it, but some. The feature story they did 2 years ago about my show in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, it was a cover story on a Sunday edition. So that was seen by probably 500,000 people. And it was done in a very positive light. The lady that did that interview with me and the other preppers that were featured in it did a really good, fair view of what we're doing. So some of that's gone on. But I think more than that, you know what's happened? People have realized that we're not as safe as we think we are. People have realized that the politicians are lying, that the news channels are lying. Many of them don't know exactly how the lies are being told. They're not exactly sure what's wrong with the story, but they know that it's not quite kosher anymore. And this uneasiness has put people in touch with a very important survival instinct. There's a primal instinct in human beings that recognizes danger as soon as we get out of the myopathy of normalcy bias. And it's a very uncomfortable thing, and people have two reactions when they experience it. they bury their head deeper in normalcy bias, and some people are going to do that. But many people will, once they feel that, say, oh, I got to do something about this. I'm not sure what. And that presents an opportunity to spread the message. And I think that is a big part of what's going on. And this primal instinct I'm talking about, let's go back 5,000 years. And there's a group of hunter-gatherers somewhere on the African savannah, and they have their campfire and their little huts and all, and they're sitting around the campfire cooking some food and doing what humans have done since they've learned how to communicate. They're singing songs and telling stories and being collectively together. And one of them goes off a little bit to eliminate some waste, to leave it at that. And as he or she is doing that, the hackles go up on the neck. There's no sound. There's no reason to believe that there's anything wrong. They haven't seen or heard or smelled anything, but there's a sense. And that sense tells them that a lion, a leopard, some type of predator is close. And because that sense is there, they have an opportunity to get the rest of the community involved in some level of defense to slowly back away. They know not to run, and they know not to just sit there. They know that they have to do something. And that's how we survived. And that is still in us. We can't bury it with computers and iPods and all these other things. That is a primal instinct that will always be in the human being. And it serves a purpose. Now, we have to be smart with it. Because this is the danger for people as they start to see the prepper industry as a solution, is they panic and they do stupid shit and they end up with a garage full of crap that they never use, and eventually nothing happens that they really need that stuff for, and they feel dumb and they get rid of it. Y2K, that was exactly what happened to literally over 1 million people, I believe, filled up garages full of crap that they didn't need or understand. And when, you know, January 1st came around, they were like, what do I do with all this? And their brother-in-law and their sister-in-law and their brother and their father and their kid that was all telling them, you're a dumbass, seemed like he was right. So they went from the perfect opportunity to really bring self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and liberty into their own lives, and they threw it away. And now they're not as receptive anymore. So we have to be careful with that. And this is how that primal instinct plays in. If that hunter-gatherer that's wandered away from the fire felt that hackle, and if he runs, the second he runs, that leopard or that lion, bam, he's dead. Right? The claws are going in, the bite is going into the neck, he's going to break the neck and drag him away, and all his friends and family can do is listen to him be chewed up. And that's the key, right? The consequence isn't as severe today when we overreact, but we learn from that. So what we want to do is we want to give people very simple first steps. We want to tie them into resources, hopefully like my show and other great resources that are out there. But we just want to kind of talk to them a little bit about how they feel and what they would do if some of these things happened. I also think that another thing that's made people receptive, tsunamis in Japan, nuclear problems in Japan, nuclear problems in the United States now, the tornado rampage of 2011. You can only call it a tornado rampage. There's been more tornadoes thus far in 2011 than we generally get in an entire year, and we're only halfway through the year. Seeing these images, and there's been a lot of things lately like that, the Haitian earthquake, the Chilean earthquake, these things make people ask the question, feel the hackles, get into touch with that primal urge, and that is a great time to share with them. So those are my thoughts on that. I appreciate you spreading the message. The more people that we can bring into the preparedness lifestyle, the better off we'll all be when something happens, because sooner or later something will happen, and it will affect you. It may not affect all of us at the same time, but there is almost no one listening to the sound of my voice today that unless your troubles are ended by being hit by a 10-wheeler tomorrow, at some point between now and the grave, you're not going to run into something. We're all going to run into something. Hopefully, we'll be able to get through it, and the more of us that are prepared for it, the more we'll be able to aid and help each other. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hey, Jack. This is Survivor on the Forums. I wanted to report on my experience with the ground net, which I don't know if people realize, but it has a lot of potential as a kind of a wild food source. But I ordered about 85 seeds from North Carolina and then about 25 to 30 tubers from Sand Mountain in Alabama. And I had initially good success sprouting them on a windowsill or the seeds under grow lights. And some of the other ones that are kind of like not growing as fast, especially the ones from the seeds. And I planted a bunch just right in the ground without in my bug out location in Maine right after the snow was melting. and at my mother's house, and most of the, none of those have really come up. My mother thinks they could have drowned or whatever, because we had a lot of rain. But some of the ones I planted from that I had sprouted from grow lights, I planted in Maine as well, and they weren't really they kind of petered out, and I just put some more up there, and I dug a bunch of sand up from my driveway and mixed it in with some clay like soil up there, because I'd heard that they like sandy soils, and give them that another shot. And I'm going to sprout more from grow lights, but I was wondering what your experience was or any advice you might have. It seems like a really good source of food anyway, but I have a drip irrigation off my yurt roof. It just kind of goes to a soaker hose that, from the overflow. It's about 300 feet down from the yurt there, but it's kind of wet in there in the spring, but I don't know, what it might dry up a bit in the summer, so... thanks a lot. All right, bye.
Well, let's start out with the seeds. I can't help much with. I've never grown groundnut from seed. I've always propagated them from tubers. You're a bit farther north than the native range of groundnut. And for my international listeners, some people out there use groundnut synonymously with peanuts. A typical nut that you would eat, the shell. It's not really a nut, but we call it a nut. Groundnut's also a nut, but it's not a nut that we call a nut that's not a nut. But it's better known as Apis americana, and it is a native plant to North America, and it grows little tubers that are sort of like a cross between a nut and a potato is the best way I can describe them. And they're a great food source. They're higher in protein than just about any other non-meat source. They're relatively close to being as high in protein as an egg. That's how valuable that they are. They also have quite a bit of inulin, so they're good for diabetics, they're good for appetite control, and they're a great powerhouse of nutrients. So they are a great thing to grow. Now, your success or failures in Maine, I don't really know what your growing environment is. My biggest concern is it too shaded? Groundnut is kind of an edge plant. In its native habitat, it will grow either in clearings or at the edges of the sun, like the south side edge of a forest. So as cold as it gets there, you may have actually froze them beyond repair. Maybe that's why they didn't come up for you. If they don't get enough solar exposure, and especially planting them just as the snow's melting, there's a lot of freezing that goes on there. The tubers, though, if they're in the ground, should be okay. They should still come up unless they just don't get warmed enough and they don't get enough solar exposure to really grow. So those are some things that you can try. They're kind of really, the native range of them is really kind of around the Virginia area. So it's a little bit cooler up where you're at, and it's a little bit warmer down where I'm at. But I've had no trouble getting them to grow here. Big thing you want is, it's not only sandy soil, but you want loose soil so that they can form their tubers and so they can spread. And other than that, they should actually do quite well for you. I would check mostly on your solar exposure and your time of planting. Maybe the tubers will be fine over winter, but you need to kind of get them established. And I don't know the condition of the tubers that you planted. I, too, though, have found the best results by starting them in pots and then moving them out to a location. That's worked best for me. I get them to where they have several feet of growth on them. They're a vining plant. Some of the vine will go across the ground and actually put feeders into the ground and spread the tubers, and some of the vines will climb up to seek more light. So those are some things you can try. You're going to definitely, if you do like a prepared bed with good quality soil and make that your groundnut bed and make sure it gets good solar exposure and start harvesting in your second year and never harvest more than 50% of what's available, that's the formula for success with groundnut. I'll be putting a groundnut bed in our location here in Arkansas, and I'll be doing videos on it and showing you how we do that and how it progresses, and we'll be 2 years from harvest. And that's one of the things that's made groundnut not quite so successful as a commercial crop. It was really looked at heavily during the colonial times, but because it took so long and because you could grow tobacco in half a season and make a lot of money on it, well, it didn't get a lot of love from the Virginians in the colonial days, and they just went out in the woods and found it. So that's the best I can do for you on groundnut. I would encourage anybody out there to consider growing it. It is a bit late in the year to start it, but it should do okay in most climates. I don't really know its northernmost range, but a quick Google has told me what the range is, and you should not have problems. It's hardy from zone 4B, which is kind of right on the zone 5-4 border. up to zone 8B, which means that I should have no problems just as I'm not having any problems. So your cold hardiness on the low end is down to 25 below zero Fahrenheit because it is underground. So I'm going to suggest a couple things. One, the quality of the soil, and two, the solar exposure. You want part shade. You do not want full shade. And if you've got it kind of in a really heavily shaded area, it could be a problem. If it's getting too much sun, that could be a problem. But it should at least grow and then kind of dwindle on you. So those are the two things I'm going to suggest you check out. And everybody, I'm going to suggest, consider groundnut, making it part of your permaculture efforts and your perennials in your home growing. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hey, Jack. This is Richard from Spring Hill, Florida, also known as Auburn Football on the forums. I just want to make a couple of quick comments about the pepper spray conversation from episode 673. I just want to preface this by saying I've been a cop for most of my adult life, been certified to teach OC, and I've been on scene and have used pepper spray during a lot of incidents. OC or pepper spray is very, very effective, and in most cases, when properly applied, it does a job. However, sort of like shooting a guy that's running at you with a knife, it's a lot easier said than done to get that proper application. The attacker is going to be moving, and your target area, which is the eyes and nose, is relatively small. Plus, pepper spray is going to have a limited range, especially these smaller ones we tend to carry with us. There is a significant likelihood of missing your target and having little, if any, effect. Trust me, I've been there. But that isn't to say you shouldn't carry pepper spray, but you just need to know its limitations. Also, cross-contamination is going to be a big factor with any kind of pepper spray you carry, a foam stream or whatever, there's a good chance you're going to catch at least a little bit of the effects from it. If you can, attend a class, get sprayed with the stuff. It really sucks, but it teaches you not to panic when you experience the effects. If the first time you feel the effects is when you use it for real, you're possibly going to panic because it hurts really bad and it feels like it's suffocating you. If you think you can't breathe, you're going to do a lot of stupid things that are contraindicated for your own survival. I just want to say that pepper spray is a great intermediate or less than lethal weapon, but it has its limitations. Just like a gun, there are no magic bullets. Thanks for all you do, and stay safe.
Okay, it's definitely the voice of experience of someone who's done this a lot, and I don't disagree with anything the gentleman said. And I appreciate your call, and I appreciate your concerns, and I definitely agree with taking a class on it. I'm not real hip on being sprayed with it, probably because it's already happened to me and probably because I've already experienced CS gas in the military in my training there and don't really feel I need that again. But it sucks, but I guess it probably is really a good thing to do. But if you are not comfortable with it, I wouldn't let not doing it prevent you from carrying it. I also want to talk about a couple things. One, I would love some of the law enforcement officers that are out there to get your department to consider trying a product called Inferno made by Cold Steel as your OC option. I don't know what the process, I'm sure some departments it's easy to get something in for trials and some it's hard, but I'd love to hear back from law enforcement on this product. They're not a sponsor. I have no real direct affiliation with them. I just love their product and I'm very impressed with it and I'd like to see some real world trials with it. What I like about the Cold Steel product, again, it's called Inferno, is it comes out like a foam and it immediately on contact melts like a liquid, which prevents the person receiving it from being able to grab it and fling it back. And it reduces overspray and surrounding spray. And the trials that I saw done, of course, it was done by Cold Steel, when they sprayed it in these inside buildings on people that allowed themselves to be sprayed, the people standing around them did not experience any overspray or any indirect exposure, which is very unusual. So I don't think it completely eliminates it, but I do think it reduces it. So that's one thing I would say, and that's why I recommend that brand, because everything the guy that just called said is true. But I also want to talk about the difference between OC spray, pepper spray, whatever you want to call it, for a law enforcement officer and a civilian. And I think it's very important that we keep this in mind. A law enforcement officer has to use this as a tool for apprehension and control of the individual. In other words, the person has to be sprayed, and then the person has to be taken down and put into custody. I think it would be highly unlikely the law enforcement officer, whether they're in a jail situation using it for control there or in the field using it for apprehension, would ever be spraying somebody without then immediately trying to put them in cuffs and take them away. And I absolutely can't think of any time that that would ever occur. This is exactly not, again, not what we would be doing as a civilian. When you are using OC spray as a civilian, you're, and I know the civilian world, there, that's one of those things I shouldn't say, as a private individual not involved in law enforcement, because our law enforcement officers are considered civilians in the U.S., by the way. But when you're using it that way, your intention is to stop the attack long enough to extricate yourself from it. All right, and I am a big believer in carrying a gun and having a gun and using it as lethal self-defense if necessary. So at any point that I felt threatened beyond the capability to do that, I'm drawing down and firing. And I think you need to practice with both implements to be able to do that. And I do think, again, training on any type of self-defensive weapon is a good idea. But I do want to always, when people have concerns or objections or even mitigation to pepper spray, draw that line of delineation. A law enforcement officer that then has to apprehend the guy that's just been coated with it is going to get a lot more exposure to it than the person who sprays and runs. And the big thing in these self-defense situations, it's no time to be a hero. It's not about being a hero. It's about getting your ass home safe and alive to your family. So please always understand that difference and understand that a law enforcement official is always going to have a view of any means that he uses as restraint or self-defense based on that use being used for apprehension or crowd control. And while there's a lot we can learn from that, there's a big difference between that and just trying to get away. The overspray is a huge issue. We had a product, I can't remember who made it. I think it was Spitfire or something like that. It's a company down in Austin. I really liked the container, the way it was designed. It had a little thumb press thing so that you could hold it in your hand and point your fist forward instead of holding it like a spray bottle. But because it was plastic, and I wrote the company and asked them to make one aluminum or something, the backside that screwed in to do the replacement canister constantly failed. And my wife had it come apart on her while she was coming in the house carrying her keys where she had it attached. It fell to the ground and made one, when it hit the ground, it caused the canister to discharge for just a half a second. It didn't hit her directly. She got the overspray, and when she came in the house, when she was sneezing and coughing, she was sneezing and coughing up blood. So some people can have a very severe reaction to it. Again, this is why I like the Cold Steel product. I have not allowed myself to be sprayed with it. I have taken canisters when I've gotten to a point where I'm like, time to replace this, and I replace mine every 6 months. And I've gone outside, I've sprayed trees with it, and it did function properly after 6 months. I go way early with my rotation of this. It's cheap, and I'm going to bet my life on it. I'm going to rotate it, okay? And I've done this with other products. And almost every time I've sprayed a product, specifically outdoors where there's any kind of a breeze, I've gotten overspray. I can't say it'll never happen with the Inferno product, but what I can tell you is in my personal testing and in the reviews that I've read on it and all the video that I've seen Cold Steel do, it has the least propensity for of it any product out there. Now, again, that's like saying so-and-so bullet has the least propensity to penetrate through your walls. It still might do it, okay? So there you go. Those are my thoughts. Thank you for your words of wisdom, and thank you for your service in the field. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hi, Jack. This is Phil from Table Rock Lake. I'm just north of you on the Missouri-Arkansas line. It appears to me that fuel prices will continue to rise. Do you think the government will subsidize diesel to prevent the collapse of just-in-time delivery of food and other essentials so there won't be riots in places like New York, LA, and Washington, D.C.? Also, do you think it would be dyed like farm diesel to prevent personal use, not necessarily the same color? And one more question, are there any signals that you would monitor that you think would signify an irreversible course to the collapse of our economy? Thanks for all you do. Bye.
Great stuff. Thanks for that call. Let's start out with the first question. Fuel prices going up and the subsidizing of diesel fuel for long-haul truckers. And you know, dyeing that fuel. And let's talk about that a little bit. I think there's a lot of people that don't know this. You can go out and buy diesel fuel for a hell of a lot cheaper than you'll get it at the gas pumps and your standard gas stations. Usually you have to go to kind of a fuel depot or a supply area for construction equipment or farm equipment that sells this. Your larger fuel depots again do this. The diesel's red dyed. You look at it, it looks almost like cherry Kool-Aid. It's that red. And what is different about it than the diesel that's on the road today? And I don't know if it's the ultra-low sulfur like we use now. It may be. I'm not sure. But back, you know, before we had that, it was exactly the same diesel that was on the road. I really haven't kind of kept in touch with that. Somebody could let me know in the comments today, is the red dye diesel today the same as what's on the road, or is it like the diesel fuel we had before the ultra-low sulfur stuff came out? Anyway, the purpose of that is that when you buy diesel fuel, just like gasoline, you pay a tax on it. And the tax is designed to support roads and things like that. Well, farmers and construction equipment operators run an awful lot of equipment on diesel, far more than they do on gasoline. And long ago it was decided that it wasn't fair for them to pay a road tax since they were using it primarily for agricultural use. So they came up with this concept of they won't tax you the way they do for on-the-road fuel. So you cut all the taxes out, basically, and you buy the fuel without paying the highway and the state and local taxes on the gas, or on the diesel fuel in this case. And, you know, along the way, construction workers said, hey, we can use that. We're not on the road. So if you're running a tractor for the farm, if you're running a backhoe that runs diesel, anything like that, you can use this red dye diesel. And you save some money on it. And what the caller's saying is, hey, do you think they'll do that for over-the-road trucking if fuel prices continue to rise? Let's start out with the first premise, that fuel prices will continue to rise. And then let's answer this hypothetically as if they do or will in the future. I don't think that fuel prices are going to continue to go up in the short term. The economy is off the rails again. We're in a decline. People are contracting more than ever. The demand for fuel is going down in the United States yet again. People are doing everything they can to cut expenses in a horrible, horrible train wreck of an economy. So that's going to keep a lid on fuel prices. And fuel prices typically, and I wrote an article on this a long time ago on The Real Truth About Money blog, TRTAM. You might want to check that site out. I just did a post to it yesterday. But generally speaking, as the economy rises and fuel prices rise with it, at some point the fuel goes high enough to suppress the economy. And those two kind of keep each other in check. But kind of the rules are being broken now because the economy sucks and fuel's going up at the same time. So I still think we've got kind of a cap that we've hit. We won't see $5 diesel in the current climate. We'll have to have the semblance of a recovery, or we'll have to have a real increase in output, production, and utilization in some other parts of the world, like China and India. So they can drive up fuel prices. But between now and, let's say, the end of this year, I don't see a real big run-up in fuel prices. I just don't. In fact, I see further contraction of oil this year. I don't think that'll be forever. I have deep concerns about the long-term oil supply, but short-term, we'll see a contraction. Let's say it does. Let's say I'm wrong and it does go up, or let's say next year something happens and it goes up. Would the government at some point say, well, we got to subsidize fuel for truck drivers? Yes, I think they would. I think they would get to a point where they'd say, we got to make sure everybody's supplied. It's a dangerous thing, though, because then the average person wants to know, well, if they get it for less, why don't I get it for less? Well, because they're bringing you food, stupid, but the average sheeple will not comprehend that. Would they dye the fuel? Probably not. What they would probably do is give truckers some kind of a card, something like a gas card that would simply charge the trucking company for a portion and the government for a portion, or more likely what they would do is do it through a tax subsidy where the company or the independent could keep their records. There's very few independents left, by the way, but the ones that are out there are, could keep their fuel records and on their quarterly and annual tax filings get a rebate for a portion of the fuel used. That's only going to do so much, though, because there's the out-of-pocket running costs and operational costs. So that would be a great way to squeeze more independents into working for a company. The company can afford to take a loan from the bank in the interim and make those stretches in between their quarterly filings, where the independent may not be able to survive week to week paying for the additional fuel. So those are my thoughts on that. They probably wouldn't create a new version of dyed fuel. They would probably create some type of a program using tax return. if this new fuel that we're using today is, if they're just making the same stuff and they're just red dyeing that now, what they may say is that over the road truckers that drive a certain amount of mileage can purchase and use the red dye diesel. That might be the easy answer in that case, which would be giving the tax money back as well. So, now, a sign that the U.S. economy has entered a point where it will decline and never recover. That's not going to happen. Hear me out. All right. Our economy won't decline and never recover. What our economy will do is change and metamorphosize into something new. There is no way that a nation that's our size, with our natural resources, with our population, with our level of education, with everything that we have, is going to just economically collapse. Okay? We will economically collapse. But to have that big Patriot scenario, it's got to take more than just an economic collapse. The economy of the United States has collapsed many times. I don't think people realize our currency's collapsed multiple times. Every time they changed the currency, it was because the previous one failed. Since the Federal Reserve took control, being change number one to the Federal Reserve System, so that's change number one coming up to today. All of the changes involved are five times. We had Bretton Woods. We had Bretton Woods II. We had a partial gold standard. We had a full gold standard. We had no gold standard. Every time that happened, that was a currency collapse and being replaced and rebased with a new currency model. So if we have a place where the economy dies, so to speak, somebody somewhere will come up with some new idea, sell it to the sheeple as a solution, and create a new economy, and everybody will get burned except the people in control, but there'll still be an economy. There'll still be a United States, or if we ever totally screw things up, the people that live here under a different name, like North American people under a North American Union, will have an economy. It's not just going to go away. The spirit of your question, though. I know what you're saying. You're saying, when do I know that I'm screwed? And I better just take and get everything I can before it's over with. That is really hard to answer, but here is my scenario I laid out yesterday in brief. And this is going to happen, in my view. I could be wrong, but this is what I feel is going to happen. The cities begin to default. A couple cities have already had that problem. I had a person on the blog yesterday ask me which cities aren't paying on their bonds. They're not defaulting on their bonds yet. They're defaulting to their retirees. They're defaulting to basically what they're doing is they're even getting to the point where they're cutting essential services just to stay afloat. And then they're going to the state saying, help. And right now the states are stepping in and helping. Well, once you do it for one of your kids, you got to do it for all your kids, right? So when a lot of these municipalities start having this problem going to the states, they'll put an undue burden on the states. The states themselves are in danger of defaulting. We've had reports out that basically say like 38 states are on the verge of bankruptcy. As those states begin to default, again, the federal government can only step in and save some money, so many kids. But once you save one kid, all the kids want to be saved. Hey, help me too. Stimulus three. And eventually the federal government caves in under that weight. And then what we have is a situation where the entire nation, its cities, and its states are in a debt default. And that will be when the new currency is introduced as a solution. And it will be probably gold-backed. And what will happen is you'll get new dollars, but your dollars will buy less. It'll be like a big giant shot of inflation all at once. And it actually will take a little time to figure itself out as people price things under the new model, just like it's happened before. And that will signal the end of this current run that started in 1913 and led toward the debt end of the spectrum. It'll switch back to a commodity end of the spectrum. And a lot of people are going to get really hurt when that happens. How do you know when that's coming? When you start to see more than one or two cities in this situation, and when you start to see a state say, can't help you, because we're screwed too. And really, when you see the first state go to the Fed and say, we're screwed, help us. And that will probably be California. That will probably California or Hawaii will be the first one that will have to do that. I would say New York, but I think they can play games up there a little longer than California can. California is releasing prisoners because they don't have enough money. I mean, that's how bad things are getting there. So that's my scenario. I went long on it, but you gave me three questions. I gave you three answers. Let's take another one.
Hi, Jack. It's Dave from Upper Michigan. Hey, I was listening to the self-sufficient gardener the other day, and he made mention of your composting plan of using three, like, 50-gallon or 33-gallon garbage pails. And what you do then, if you have three, you have two of them composting and working, and the other one's empty. So then after a week or two or whenever you need to stir them, you can just pick one of them up, dump it in the empty one. Now you've got a new empty one to dump the other one in, and you're effectively turning it over. My question is this. He said, yeah, I drill a bunch of holes in those garbage pails. Well, how many? What kind of diameter? Those would be very practical but very helpful for me if I'm wanting to compost a lot. I've got two horses, and horses poop 8 times a day, and that's a lot of compost that I can go through. So if I can do it right, that would be most helpful. Also, I'd like to know how long it takes each garbage pail to be fully composted. I know you'll kind of know it when the temperature goes down and all that. So some practical guidelines on that. I want to set this thing up, and man, I could make a whole lot of really good compost. Thanks a lot, Jack. Appreciate your work. Say bye.
Okay, and this is not any attempt to sell more MSB memberships, but a 30-minute video on the full construction of that composting system is available in the Member Support Brigade in the download area of your private area of the Member Support Brigade. I did that as a 30-minute video, and I put it out as an exclusive piece of content for the Members Brigade. That doesn't mean I won't answer your question. It just means if you want to see it all, that would be one way to do it. Next, I want to be clear what my system is really for. My system is for dealing with relatively small amounts of compost because you're dealing with the garbage cans. And I do use, I think they're 32 or 38-gallon cans that I used for my system. You can use anything you want as far as doing that. But it's really designed for like the house, you know, like the leftover kitchen scraps and stuff like that, because you can only fill them so far before you need to transfer them to the other one, because a 32-gallon can full of waste that's composting and kind of flattening down as it happens gets pretty heavy. So you get them to about the halfway point, and as you continue to go forward with the composting, you get more dense material, right? So you might fill one all the way up to the top, and it'll cut down about halfway, and you dump it to your second one, and that might not be that heavy. But if you keep adding to that pile and kind of building it back up, by the time it's like 3/4 full and it compacted down and ready for its final rotation, it gets kind of heavy. So here's what I've taken to doing with that system. I layer it with, it's kind of like at the beginning, I'm just throwing all the crap from the kitchen, the leftover crap and all in there. And at some point, as I get a pretty good size amount of material in there, I'll go collect some green and brown material from, like, you know, leaves and glass clippings and things like that. I really, when I was in Texas using this, when I mowed the lawn, I had some big patches of clover, and when I had a mower that would either discharge to the side or bag, and I would switch it to bag whenever I went over the clover, and I put all that great nitrogen-rich clover in there. But I kind of build that up till it's almost full, and I let that cook down one time, and I flip it only once, and I let it finish off in that second one, and it does pretty well. As for exactly how I kind of set this up, it's really not anything special. I use a drill bit that's like designed for cutting holes, a hole saw bit, a 1-inch, I think, is what I used, either that or a 7/8, but it's not that critical. And all I did was I went around the top and I drilled them kind of evenly spaced, and there's like markings on the garbage can. I kind of used those as my guides. I did the same thing around the bottom. So just about an inch down from the top and an inch up from the bottom, I've got just a series of 1-inch holes all the way around. They're probably spaced about 4 to 5 inches apart. Again, usually there's some kind of depression or marking on the trash can you can use as a guide to get some even spacing. Then I flipped it upside down, and in the bottom, I did the same thing, about the same spacing. So around the outer ring of like the outside of the can, there's a 1-inch hole. And people say, well, how does the stuff stay in there? Well, it's all thick material, and by the time it's composted, it's wet, it sticks together, it doesn't come out. So that's the outside of the can. The kind of the ingenious thing that I came up with is if you go to Home Depot, you'll find this perforated pipe that's made for making drains. It looks like 4-inch white PVC, but it's got a series of holes in it. I take one of those and I cut it just short enough so it'll go inside the can with the lid on it. And I also drill holes. Actually, I didn't drill any holes in the lid. That way, when it rains, you don't get too much water in there, and it helps control the moisture as you wet it down. So you can keep it covered. You can leave it open. Either way is fine. But I have used the lids, and I have not put holes in the lids. The pipe then has a smaller piece of pipe, about a 1-inch piece of pipe, that has a series of holes drilled in it, about quarter-inch drill bit holes drilled in it. And it goes in through one of the holes in the bottom, and it goes into the pipe. And that creates a venting system so that air can come in from the outside and go up the center. And I also took the hole saw and drilled more holes in the perforated pipe, so it's got holes all the way around it. So if you look down the center of the composting system, you've got compost all around, or decaying matter turning into compost all around, a 4-inch white pipe that creates an air channel. It works very, very quickly. If you stack it heavy, so again, I throw all my kitchen scraps into one. When it builds up a little bit, I start to add some other stuff. I give it one turn, and then I stack the shit out of it, and I just leave it in there. Because again, it's going to be heavy. So that's what I'm going to go, and I'm going to add some manure. I'm going to add some grass clippings. I'm going to add some brown leaves. And I'm going to do this kind of like a lasagna layered effect to get a good mix of it. Add some of this, add some of that until it's full to the top. I put the lid on it and leave it go. And at that point, I probably spent maybe 3 to 4 weeks of getting rid of kitchen waste, moved it with some other stuff to the secondary for composting, filled it up, and I get within 90 days fully composted material because of that airflow. All I've got to do is add a little bit of water once in a while to keep it moist, and that's it. And you'll know when it's done because, again, you'll stick your hand down in there, and it'll be beautiful brack dirt, and it won't be hot anymore. So that's how it works. Now, if you have a bunch of horses crapping all the time, this is probably not the best system for you. You're probably going to be better off building a larger scale system using pallets or something like that, or just big piles, and turning them over with a manure fork and bringing in some browns and greens and stuff like that. Again, this was a small scale system really designed for the home composter that doesn't have a tremendous amount of material to work with. You are definitely going to be better off with just a big pile or a multi-bin system or something like that with the amount of waste you have to work with. So there's how you do it, and you might want to set it up and use it with a little bit of manure here and there, because the manure is a great addition. Not only does it help give you a great finished product because it's manure, but the nutrients in it help the process of, you know, things breaking down quicker. So you'll do very well using manure for that. But it would be kind of for your kitchen scrap compost, a little bit of extra matter. If you want to make a large amount of compost, a bin system or simply a series of piles somewhere is going to be the way to go. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hey, Jack, this is John from Texas. Love your show, by the way. I was just wondering, could you use the Berkey filter, water filter system, to purify raw milk? It takes the pathogens out, but would it take more of the other stuff out, too? I was thinking about purchasing one, but for water purposes, but just wondered if it would take care of the E. coli or worries about raw milk. Thanks. I'll be hoping to hear you on the air. Thanks. Bye.
I have no flipping idea in the world. I don't know. If anybody wants to comment on that, you can. I will tell you this. It'd be something that I know that if I asked Jeff, the Berkey guy, what he would say is, I don't know. It's not what it's made for. And I think that's probably the best I can do there. There's some questions I just don't know the answer to. And I don't know. I would think that it might take out a lot of other things. I don't really understand the, you know, chemical composition of milk. I would wonder why you would feel the need to do that. People have been drinking raw milk for a long time with no health problems whatsoever until our government told us it was dangerous and wanted to put bovine growth hormone in it and cause our girls to go into puberty 2 to 3 years earlier and all kinds of stuff like that. So I don't really think that raw milk needs a lot of jacking around with. Now, if it came from an unsafe facility, I'd say don't drink it. But I know quite a few members of the audience that keep cows and or goats that drink raw milk all the time with no problems. There are certain standards to keep as far as cleanliness and things like that, but I don't, you know, it's good enough for the calf, or it's good enough for the kid goat. It's probably good enough for us. But again, on the actual question, just don't know. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hi, Jack. This is Heavy G. I have a question about couponing. I saw something on TV, and there's been some talk on the forums about all kinds of just amazing deals and getting stuff for way less than it normally would cost, and that seems to be a if times get tough or even if they don't, kind of thing. So what are your thoughts on couponing and wonder maybe some resources out there? Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, if I claim to be anything nearing an expert on couponing, it would be a lie. Pretty much we clip coupons for stuff that we're going to buy anyway, and when we buy it anyway, we use the coupon, and sometimes we wait for a sale so we can double the coupon up, and we definitely like double coupon days. That's about as good as it gets with us. And my wife's looking into it more. She's getting into more of going to websites and printing out coupons. And we've created kind of a form email that tells certain manufacturers that don't generally give coupons how much we like their product. And we found that by sending that to their contact address, sometimes they'll send you coupons back, either by mail or they'll send something electronic that you can use. And this gets you coupons of things that you actually enjoy using that you generally don't find clipping in the paper. So that's about my personal experience. I have been watching this show called Extreme Couponing, and I'm willing to bet that's kind of what you've been looking at if you're asking this question. It is kind of neat. I don't think that what you see these people do is real typical of what they do all the time, though. I think they wait for big sales, they wait for double coupon days, and they find exceptional coupons and piece it all together and do it. I find very few coupons that would let me use more than one or two of them, so when these people go in and buy like 80 bottles of vitamin water and make 15 cents on each one and then use that money to buy something else, I don't know how they pull that off. But I am interested in this, and I don't know how much of it I'll ever do, but I know it's something the audience would be interested in. And on that note, I'm going to be contacting later today a lady from a website I gave out during one of the money-making shows called Sarah's Deal. She wants to come on the show as a guest, and she's into couponing and sales and things like that. That's what her website's all about. Again, it's called Sarah's Deals. And I'll have her on the air next week sometime, probably like Thursday or something like that, and we'll ask her some of these questions. Of course, the Saving Money shows that we just did a whole series on, there's a ton of links to sites that provide coupons and information about coupons within all of those resources. With that, let's go ahead and take another call.
Jack, this is Ryan from Washington once again. I just finished listening to episode 653, and you were talking about Liberty. And one of the things that I've noticed is that people will always refer to the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, they might talk about the Fourth and the Fifth, and there's some references to 6, 7. And my point is that 9 and 10, which are the ones that are fundamental to our individual liberty, our individual freedoms, and the state liberty, seem to be largely ignored. And I'm just wondering why that is, if you have any insight into that. And, you know, even if, you know, most of the people that are listening aren't aware of it, just kind of what 9 and 10 are and what they're supposed to do. Anyway, once again, thanks for the show, and set the try.
Let's start out with a reading and a basic understanding of these two amendments. They're both very, very simple, very, very short, and very, very freaking clear to anybody that wants to understand them and not try to make a big deal about the living document of interpretation. The Ninth Amendment says, and this is a quote, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." So some people may not understand what the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights means. That means if it doesn't say that you have the right in the Constitution, it doesn't mean that you don't have the right. And let's talk about the purpose of the Ninth Amendment in the first place. When the Constitution had been ratified, the Bill of Rights was the first 10 amendments. It was one of the first things ever added to our Constitution. That's what an amendment is, an addition. And there were two schools of thoughts on a Bill of Rights, and there was a great deal of concern among our founders that if we do this Bill of Rights, because the Constitution really doesn't talk about rights, it talks about the structure and the restrictions of the form of government of a republic. It sets up the system. The Bill of Rights is the first time we start really taking specific individual rights and making them part of our foundational law. So one school of thought said, man, we better do this because there's people already trying to say people can't do things that they should be able to do. The other school of thought was, well, right now there's no precedent for what people can and can't do. So basically, the government's under the tether of the people, and it's up to the people to retain their freedom. And if we do a Bill of Rights, if we leave something out, if something in the future happens that changes things, and there isn't a specific thing that says you have a right to that in the Constitution, the government will say, then you don't. And they will use it to step on the rights that we would already be perceived to be had. In other words, by putting the rights in text, we'll limit how many of them there are. So the compromise was, we'll come up with this Ninth Amendment. And this Ninth Amendment will say, hey, in case we forgot anything, you don't get to screw with that either. That's what the Ninth Amendment says. The Tenth Amendment is like, maybe you didn't get it, so let's make sure you completely get it. So the quote verbatim of the Tenth Amendment. And again, it's amazing how short and simple these are and how courts have tried so much attempt to make them mean something they don't. The Tenth Amendment is, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That means, very, very simple, the powers not given to the United States by the Constitution, the United States being the federal government. If the power is not given to you in the Constitution, and the states have not prohibited you from doing it, then that power lies in the state government or to the people as individuals. In other words, in a republic, the sovereignty starts, it's a bottom-up pyramid with the individual. The sovereignty lies in me, Jack Spiegel. I am first a sovereign human, a sovereign person, and a sovereign citizen of the United States. Not to be confused with this bullshit sovereign citizen movement where people think that they can get away with not paying taxes and driving without a freaking driver's license, right? A true sovereign citizen. I inherently have the most power in the republic. And then I delegate some of that power to the states, and then the states collectively delegate some of that power to the federal government. We have turned that on its head, where the federal government is the all-powerful, the states are secondary, and the citizen is a third class, right? Is the third level, the peon. Well, the Tenth Amendment says exactly the opposite. If we didn't say you could have it in the Constitution, you don't get it. If the states want to restrict what you can do within the bounds of the Constitution, they can. So either the Constitution has to say you can do it, and the state, and at the same time, the states have had not say you can't do it. So this is an example. The federal government can do something that's not in the Constitution, right? But according to the Tenth Amendment, then what happens is the state has the ability to restrict that and say, not in our state. It's nice you want to do that, feds. We're glad you want to do that. That's fine. But it's not in the Constitution. So we're going to pass a resolution that says it doesn't apply in the state of Nebraska, Virginia, Texas, Florida, whatever. And that's constitutional. And then the next level of restriction is the people, and the people can go into the state government and say, we don't like what you're doing either, you're all fired, go away, elect new people, and control things from the state up versus the Fed down. That's what the Tenth Amendment says. Very simple. Let me read them to you again and see if they're, once you, you know, understand what the vocabulary, like things like enumeration mean, there's really not any way these can be interpreted any other different way unless you want them to be. It's very clear what they say. Again, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Jack Spirico version, just because we didn't say the people have the right to it doesn't mean they don't have the right to it. People have these rights from their freaking creator. We did this so that you couldn't step on ones that we're thinking of now, but if you think of something to step on in the future, you don't get to do it. Okay? If the Constitution doesn't say you can't do it, you can't do it. The Tenth Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The sovereignty of the nation lies in the individual who delegates to the state, who delegates to the Fed. Okay? Bottom-up ruling in a republic. Every person has a voice. Very, very simple. Now, why do we hear so little about them? Because they're the ones that are crapped on the most. That's why. It's really hard to sit Johnny and Susie down in 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, and teach them about the 9th and 10th Amendments of the Constitution in depth, and then go into current events, and Johnny and Susie go, but where does the Constitution say they can do that? So it's kind of a messy thing they don't want to talk about in our educational system. They don't want a bunch of kids going out there questioning the government. If you understand the 9th and 10th Amendments, the only thing you can do is question, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Hey, state legislature, why don't you restrict them? Do you understand the empowerment there? right? But let me read the most important line that's overlooked in the 10th Amendment, nor prohibited by it to the states. Your state has the right to restrict the federal government's action within its borders when they act in a manner that is unconstitutional. It is their duty to do so. Do you think that we want, as a society, is this puppet master society that we want a bunch of young people going, hey, the hell with this national election. Let's go to Austin. Let's go to Tallahassee, right? Do you think we want that? No, because we can make changes at the state much quicker, much easier, and much faster. A congressional district at the state level is relatively small. You can turn over a state house like that. You can scare the shit out of your state senate when you do it, too. You can get their attention real quick, and sooner or later you get the opportunity to do it to the Senate. This is the sword of the people, the 10th Amendment. I don't want to go too much deeper into that. I've probably gone along already with it, but it is important that we understand these rights. And again, the reason they're not talked about is because they cause you to question the government at every opportunity. And that's the last thing that the education system, the media, and the government want. But it's the first thing we should be teaching people. If you have a young person in your family, I want you to sit down today and I want you to have a conversation with them about the 9th and 10th Amendment. And here's what I want you to do. If they haven't heard this broadcast, which is probably better you talked about it before they hear what I think, I want you to sit down with them and I want you to go, read this, Johnny, read this, Susie. And I want you to, only thing I want you to do to help them understand it is if they don't understand what something like enumeration means, get the dictionary or go to dictionary.com, get a definition. Make sure they understand every single word, what the words mean, not the summation of the sentence. And then say, now that you understand all the words, what do you think this means? And I'll tell you what, Johnny and Susie are going to tell you what I told you in their own way. They're going to understand it perfectly clearly. You don't have to be a Supreme Court justice to understand a single freaking sentence. That's a lie that we've been sold as well. So there you go, the 9th and 10th Amendment, according to Jack Spirico, probably the most important lines in the Bill of Rights. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Hey, Jack, this is Bobo from the Forums out here in Midland, Texas. I came home recently and come home and in my garage, all three of the GFCI receptacles have been reset because we had an electrical storm. Well, I just purchased a brand new 19 cubic foot freezer to go into the garage, and it was powered from one of those GFCIs, so sure enough, it got shut off when those GFCIs went off. Well, luckily the food inside it had not gone bad. It had been about 2 days, but actually the food was still, it was about ice chest freezer temperature, so I said, okay, great, no problem. I can just reset these GFCIs and get it back and going. Well, turns out the GFCIs in the garage, all three of them, instead of being wired in parallel, they were wired in series, which means that if any one of those GFCIs got tripped off, all of them, or the one I had power to, went off with it. So two lessons here. One, if you're going to have a freezer in a garage, replace that GFCI receptacle with a regular outlet. And secondly, make sure that outlet is not fed by another GFCI, which, if it trips, turns the power off to that outlet. Just want to pass along that knowledge to you. Again, thanks for the show, and have a good day.
Definitely one of those things that I can say way back in the day, been there, done that, didn't like it, lost half of a deer and some deer ham and some other things and a lot of regular meat and stuff like that on a vacation with a GFCI receptacle that popped. And what I'm going to tell people is, it's probably not as simple as just changing out the outlet that you're plugging the chest freezer or refrigerator, for that matter, into in your garage. The series wiring that he's talking about here is very, very common. And many of the outlets in that series will not even have a GFCI little reset button on them. They'll just be controlled by one somewhere else. For instance, my house in Texas. There is a GFCI in both bathrooms, actually all three bathrooms. Those are part of a series that all of them are on a single series, and there are outlets on the front and back of the house, on the outside external outlets. They are part of that GFCI series, and then the outlets in the garage are also. So all of it is wired in that way, which means to have our freezer, our chest freezer in the garage, and not be part of that series, the only solution that we would have to that would be to actually bring new wiring on a new circuit or pull off another independent series, which is what we ended up having to have an electrician do. We had to, you know, kind of cut into the wall, and it was a little bit expensive, but I felt it was worth it to get it off that way. I do not know why the hell they're building houses this way, but this is what they do. And every house that I've had four houses now, is designed that way. The external outlets pull off the GFCIs that are in the bathrooms. And it's just freaking stupid as far as I'm concerned. As far as, you know, overloading an outside circuit because of moisture or something, that's what the freaking circuit breaker's for. It's to me, it's an asinine thing, but some asinine politician somewhere probably made it part of a code. So if you have this issue, there's a couple things that you can do. Unless you're going away for a long period of time, you don't really need a lot of energy to run a chest freezer. So one thing you could do is go out and buy yourself, and this may cost you less than having the wiring done, believe it or not, a really good UPS, like you'd use for a computer system, something in the $300 range, and that would get you quite a bit of additional power, and it would draw very little other than the cooling fan, other than when the chest freezer kicks on. That might extend you a full day at least of being totally frozen. You could set up a very simple battery backup system with an inverter, with the battery under a trickle charge with a charge controller, and keep that system there as a backup power system with a car battery and an inverter, and that would work as well. That would be far less expensive than the UPS and a better way to do it. Definitely a better way to do it. Our chest freezer right now is empty for the first time in years, and it makes me sad, but it was part of the move, and we just took any food that was in there and either ate it or canned it and put it into a different type of storage, and we are about to have some wiring done, and we'll have an independent circuit run for the chest freezer to keep it back in a utility room, and pretty easy to do with our house since it's a mobile home. But that is a definite concern. I'm glad you brought it up because it's something that unless somebody tells you, you find out the hard way. Let me also tell you this. If you're ever like plugging on a weed eater or something like that into your outlet outside of your home and all of a sudden the outlet goes dead and you can't figure out what the hell it is and you've gone to the circuit breaker and none of the circuits are broke so you flip them all anyway and it still doesn't work, go to your bathroom, look for the little button, push it in and it'll work again. That's how you find out about it the first time unless somebody tells you. So if anybody out there knows why the hell they build houses this way, why they wire houses this way, what the frickin' reasoning is into wiring my GFCI that's in my frickin' bathroom to the series of outlets that are in my garage or on the outside of my house, please comment in the show notes today and let me know that. Because whoever's responsible for it, I'd really like to frickin' wring their neck. Because I think most modern homes are built that way today. Let's go ahead and take another call. I guess the other thing you could do, but this is dangerous, just real quick, you could take out all the GFCI outlets. The ones that are in your bathroom. But that's where they belong. It's in case you drop a frickin' hairdryer into the sink or something like that. And then you would definitely be in code violation. But that would be, you know, that's definitely not recommended, but that would fix the problem. Otherwise, you're looking at, in most instances, as far, and if you know, if an electrician or somebody like that knows a way around this, my experience was the only thing we could do was go into the wall, tie into another series of lines, and there was a low enough load in that series that they were able to splice in and run me a new outlet for my refrigerator and freezer. But in some cases, the electrician told me that wouldn't be the case. I'd have to actually run completely new wiring off of a new circuit in the junction box. And so the junction box was on one side of the house, the garage was on the other. It was a freaking mess. So if you know why this is done, let me know in the show notes in a comment. And if you know a workaround for it other than the suggestions I've given, please let me know because this is a chronic issue for anybody that wants to keep anything that requires constant power, powered by an external outlet or a garage outlet in just about every home I've ever seen in America today. Let's go ahead and take another call.
Good morning, Jack. This is Matt from the Hoosier State. Hey, I'm calling a reference to episode 665. The Indiana Supreme Court decision unlawful entry into homes. If you get online, you read the PDF of the court's actual findings. It talks about the story series of bad choices that led to the findings and the activist judges that decided to make a bench law to enforce something that they think is right. It was just, in a nutshell, all of the choices that everybody made, from the homeowner to the police officer, were all bad choices, and leading to the opportunity for this judge. I guess my question is, outside of protecting my family from poor decisions by other people, with violence, what other options do you have if you start to allow poor decisions by others to affect the way you live your life, at what point what's the limit? I guess we each have to answer that ourselves, but I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts. Thank you again for everything you do, and keep on trucking, buddy. We'll see you.
Well, there's a make you think question. Here's my thoughts on it. First, real quick review of what happened. In Indiana, there was a case where a guy tried to prevent officers from searching his home. They did not have a warrant. They did not express the intent of searching under probable cause. They just did it. He got in the way. It ended up going to the court system. And the court system said, it is not a quote, but pretty damn close, if officers want to enter your home or your place of business illegally, it is okay for them to do so. And actually, let's be clear, it didn't say it's okay for them to do so. It said that you are not permitted to physically resist entry. So the cop wants to go in, he has no warrant, he has no probable cause, you tell him you don't want him to go in, he says, I'm going in anyway, according to this court decision, you have to allow him to enter. So how would I handle this if my state was stupid enough to do the same thing? If I were in that situation, I would say, officer, I just want to be clear about this. You want to go in there, and I've told you no, and you're telling me you're going in there anyway. You do not have a warrant, and you do not have and have not expressed probable cause, and you want to go in anyway. And when he says, yes, I'm going in anyway, you say, all right, I don't want you to go in. I'm formally protesting this. You do what you think you need to do, but I do not want to provide permission for you to enter my property at this time. And if he goes in, at that point, you let him go in and you fight that in the courts. Until this decision, at least, is overturned. In fact, I would say that's probably the right way to handle this in the first place. If that officer goes in there with that admission, especially if you have anybody else there to testify to that, it's a very difficult thing for them to get a conviction. Now, they can certainly haul you off to jail and make your life miserable that evening, or maybe for several weeks until you get a court date and some things like that, and maybe screw up your life completely. But the reason the court did this is because they were faced with a dilemma of, is it ever acceptable for an officer's progress to be impeded unless he's directly, you know, threatening life and limb unlawfully, right? So cop's shooting at you, and he's not supposed to be shooting at you. Can you shoot back? And the answer would be, hell yeah. I don't really know of that happening very often, but I guess it could. But in this case, nobody's life is threatened by that officer entering the facility. Now, I'm going to get the extreme other side of this telling me today, well, the cops broke into this guy's house in Arizona and shot him and he didn't do anything. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a point where there's actually a conversation going on, right? Because you can't have this situation unless you and the officer are having some type of communication with each other. Now, here's the real problem with this. If you read the full description of what happened, if you read the document the caller's alluding to, the officers had freaking probable cause. That's what they should have. All they had to do is say, sir, under the current circumstances, we have probable cause. Get out of the way, right? And if he didn't get out of the way, put his ass on the ground and go in anyway. There was a domestic disturbance. They believed that his wife was being beaten. He didn't let her come out to talk to them, and he didn't want to let them in to talk to her. That's the basics of what went on. That's probable cause all over the place. But because the officers were freaking stupid, the opportunity came up, like the caller said, for the court to legislate from the bench. My hope is that this will be overturned. My fear that is that it will not be. But what I want you to understand is this court decision does not say and does not give grounds in any way, shape, or form that the police can show up at your house, tell you they want to come in, you tell them they can't, you don't want them to, you're not giving them permission to do so. They have no probable cause, they have no warrant, they go in anyway, they find anything for that evidence to be in any way admissible. That would not be admissible evidence. It would not even qualify for an arrest, though they might arrest you anyway. But it would open the department and the officers to extreme civil liability if they did that. And I believe that if in most cases, if you have that conversation politely and logically with a police officer, they're not going to freaking do it. Cops don't like to make arrests that get and not get convictions. Right? They want the collar, as they say. Cops are not unreasonable people in general. There's bad cops. Well, there's bad freaking Catholic priests. You can ask some little boys about that. Right? But that doesn't mean the majority of cops are bad guys. And if you clearly enunciate that, what the officer's probably going to do in that situation, if he feels he needs to go in there, is invoke probable cause. And that's for you and the courts and him to debate at that point. And if you get in his way at that point, he's going to put you down or bring his buddies and they're going to put you down. If we don't have Billy Badass standoffs with the police, we generally alleviate most of these things. That doesn't mean you don't be smart. In other words, you don't say anything. You don't say anything except what's necessary when you're having a conversation with a police officer. That gets so many people sunk. My brother-in-law is a police officer. He was a detective for a number of years. Now he's a sergeant. And he told me there's so many people that they put in jail that they would have never went to jail if they had just kept their mouth shut. And they will lie to you. They'll tell you if you don't cooperate, it makes you look bad and things like that. That's all bullshit. You need to keep your mouth shut and say as little as possible in any situation. Never talk to the police if you think in any way that you're a suspect. And be careful even if you don't think you are, because you probably are, especially if somebody's been killed or something's been set on fire or something like that. You don't say shit without a lawyer, right? But if you end up in a situation where they want to enter your property and you tell them no, And I've had that experience one time, and they left, right? They did what they were supposed to do. And if they said they wanted to come in, they have to, and probable cause isn't, I think something's going on in there. It has to be that I believe that someone is imminently threatened for probable cause. Somebody's laying on the ground passed out, right? And I got to get in there to save their life. I think you're beating the shit out of your wife, and you won't let her talk to me, right? That's what happened in this case. Again, that was probable cause. Now, what is the balance? The last part of the question. When do we say, okay, you've gone too far, and we're going to have to do something outside of the next voting cycle? We're going to have to actually physically resist. That's something that every individual has to decide for themselves. My view is, as long as a remedy exists outside of that type of action, we try to utilize that remedy. If somebody were to do something in our government like suspending elections and declaring emergency powers and preventing themselves from facing the election, that to me is time for, if necessary, physical removal from office. And if that means going in and pulling them out of their chairs into the streets, that's when we're there. As long as the people have a choice, then we should use the court system and the electoral system to make our point. And we need to realize the limitations of that, and that's why I believe the best solution to all of these things are personal liberty. And to do things for yourself, to provide yourself freedom, and to not do stupid shit to make yourself a target. You know, there are people that'll say, well, I shouldn't have to do this, and instead of just going on with their life and doing whatever they think they need to do, they've got to make a big production of it. They call the local media and say, I don't want them to stop me from this, and I'm going to do it anyway. Look at me. And the next thing they know, they have a problem. Where most of the time, if they just kept their mouth shut and did what they wanted to do, nobody would have ever bothered them. So I think we need to do a lot of balancing with our personal liberties and making sure that things like, you know, I said this recently, but if you have a problem with another person or another company or something like that, and the first thing you do is go run to corporate authority or governmental authority, you're a freaking dumbass. That's going to make things longer. It's going to make things more miserable for everybody. Try to solve your own problems before you call in the authorities. Something as simple as your neighbor's kid is blaring rap music in his car every day when he comes home and shaking your windows. Go talk to the kid. Go talk to the parents. Try to resolve it. Don't anonymously call the police the first time it happens. That habit is what leads to doing it in other situations that could have been kind of turned down. So the balancing act is with ourselves as much as it is with them. We need to have self-control as much as we have control over government. Remember, the government is a reflection of the people. You may not like to hear this. You may not want to agree with this, but the reason we have the government we do in Washington today isn't because they're not listening to the people. It's because they are listening to at least 51% of the people who frickin' vote. All right? And I know that a lot of you have a hard time believing that because you surround yourself with people that think the way I do and think the way you do. But if you go into to any major urban area and start just talking to people at random, you'll see how screwed up the mentality of our nation is today. So if we want to change what the government is doing, we have to start first with self-discipline and changing ourselves and moving ourselves toward personal liberty, and then being an example and spreading that message to others so that we can collectively make the change using the system that we've been given, which, despite its flaws, I feel that a republic form of government is the greatest government that we can possibly have. It is up to people to be guardians of that republic, though. A republic should be a small government. It's a huge government today, not because the system is flawed, but because the people have laid down on the job and not done their jobs to control the runaway excess. Because, in the words of one of our founders, Benjamin Franklin, the people of the United States of America have figured out that they can vote themselves money from the Treasury. And we have a choice now. We either turn away from that and save the Republic, or we keep doing that. In the prophetic words of Mr. Franklin, it will be the end of the Republic as we know it. With that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
It's in our food these days, you know, it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer, it's like there's nothing I could do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Nobody else.